Good morning, everybody. Special welcome to Jerry Edwards and Russell Picot, who are going to present some very important work to us. Jerry, our dear old friend from the FSB, who is on his farewell tour around the world. And Russell from HSBC. I already heard the presentations that we are going to get, more or less, at the FSB meeting in Tokyo. I was truly very much impressed by the disclosure proposals that have been put forward by the FSB Enhanced Disclosure Forum. It gives us a very good feeling because we are always accused of requiring too much disclosure by our constituents, and here we have constituents that voluntarily submit quite extensive disclosures, which I truly think would be very helpful in getting better insight for investors in state of affairs in the banking system. So, again, welcome, and Jerry, are you going to kick off?
I'm delighted, Hans, to say a few introductory remarks and before turning it over to Russell for his very good in-depth presentation. Well, first of all, let me thank you, Hans, and for the invitation to come and present, and let me just express my appreciation to all of you at the board for first of all our years of dialogue and friendship, and also this opportunity to share with you about this very important initiative. I guess, Sue, there's been a handout set, hopefully, that's been presented to everyone, and I thought that just going through that, I might just start off with just a few words about the FSB. The Financial Stability Board has been carrying forward very important work with respect to the international financial regulatory reform agenda. On the first page of my handout set, I've given just a quick, very, very high-level overview of the FSB. I've tried to summarize there how it brings together national and international regulatory authorities, for example, the finance ministries, the central banks and securities authorities from 24 major financial centers around the world, including the European Commission, the Basel Committee, IOSCO, and the IIS, and also key international financial institutions, BIS, IMF, World Bank, OECD, ECB, key central bank expert groups, and very importantly, the chairman of the IISB has been a member of the Financial Stability Board from its foundation, and the chair of the IISB has also been previously a member. David Tweedy was previously a member of the predecessor to the FSB, the Financial Stability Forum. So we're delighted, Hans, to have your input in our very important policy discussions. The FSB does seek to assess and mitigate risks to financial stability, coordinate key financial regulatory policies and reforms, and also monitor implementation. And one of the key roles that we've had assigned by the G20 leaders is to comment to them on key aspects of accounting convergence and other key initiatives. Our activities have continued to include support for sound international accounting and auditing standards and practices. So my next slide summarizes very quickly, gives you just a high-level overview of the FSB's work program in 2011-2012. As you'll see there to the left, you have a picture of Mark Carney, the chairman of the FSB, who's governor of Bank of Canada, and also Simon Grayson, Secretary General, who is leading and coordinating the key work streams. We'll see two main aspects to our a very important effort. The first deals with implementation, for example, of Basel III, which draws very heavily on the work of the and encourages the work of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Very important work going forward in resolution and compensation, but also continuing policy development in a number of key areas. And I've hit some of the key ones there. Extension of the framework for systemically important financial institutions. Very important work on shadow banking, and you've seen the report that's come out on that recently. The work with respect to OT, facilitating and encouraging developments to improve the transparency and functioning of OTC derivatives markets, various data initiatives, a risk governance review, and then last but not least, very important work on risk disclosure, accounting, and external audit. So quickly, on the next slide, I thought I'd give you just a very quick picture of how this kind of came to be. As you, many of you all will remember, in 2007, a almost perfect storm was developing. But it was very difficult from the risk disclosures that were being provided at that time to have a sense for what was about to happen, the buildup of risks that were taking place within financial institutions, as well as how this all fit together to affect markets. And so if you turn to the next slide, you'll see that this prompted, as the storm began to unfold in what we first referred to as the international market turmoil, you see a request came in from the G7 to our predecessor, the Financial Stability Forum, and it asked the Financial Stability Forum to address the market turmoil and included valuation accounting as key topics. The ISB was a member of a very important working group that the FSF put together to address that request. And the FSS report to the G7 in April 2008 was truly a spark, a shining light, so to speak, and using the graphic as a background, that encouraged action in key areas, including capital, disclosure, and accounting reforms. And I really have to say the ISB was a very important part of that initiative. But the turmoil did highlight the importance to market confidence of reliable valuations, as well as useful disclosures about risks. And so there was very important work at that time. Turning to the next slide, the FSB stepped in to undertake a very important initiative to improve bank risk transparency. Our predecessor issued a report to the G7, which encouraged improved risk disclosures about structured credit products and SPEs, and it actually included a recommendation for private sector work on principles that would help to provide a foundation for better disclosures as market conditions and risk changed over time, and also identifying leading practice risk disclosures, which could provide a good example to the industry to follow in the future. That work was followed by an FSB thematic peer review report in March 2011, where they looked back to see how had the industry and various bodies taken up the recommendations at that time. We found that there was actually very good work on the part of financial institutions to provide the disclosures that we had called for in the area of structured credit and SPEs, but this particular call that's in the second sub-bullet of a private sector initiative to undertake work on improved principles and leading practice risk disclosure examples was unfortunately not taken up. And so if you turn to the next slide, you'll see that the FSB then decided to put together a roundtable on risk disclosure. We had that in December 2011. It followed the review that I mentioned on the prior page, and it involved leading financial institutions, investors, analysts, credit rating agencies, auditors, supervisors, regulators, key standard setters. We were pleased, Ian, that you were able to be there in December 2011 to represent the ISB, since Hans was undertaking his global travel program at the time. Sue, we were appreciative that you were there as well. The FASB was also represented. Russell was there. And it was really quite an amazing discussion. Key presentations, IOSCO, the securities regulators, prudential authorities, all were very well represented, as well as not only auditors, but audit regulators as well. There was a very candid dialogue at that time about risk disclosure standards and practice and needed enhancements. And the types of things I've summarized on this slide were very much discussed at that very important roundtable. The need for improvements in risk governance and risk management strategies related disclosures, as well as prioritize, summarize relevant disclosure around credit risk, liquidity risk, capital adequacy, improved information around risk-weighted assets, the need for Pillar 3 disclosures that are more integrated with financial reporting disclosures, and then also better information around scenario and sensitivity analyses. And the roundtable encouraged the FSB to facilitate work by the private sector to enhance risk disclosure practices. And one of the key takeaways was the last bullet on the page, and that is that all participants felt that IFRS 7 and the U.S. SEC's MD&A principles provided a helpful foundation, almost like a principles-based umbrella, under which steps could be taken to improve practices without necessarily requiring immediate steps by regulators to implement new regulatory requirements. So With that foundation, we turn to the next slide. We took all of this to our plenary, which is the FSB senior policymaking body. We issued a press release on our risk disclosure next steps. We had calls, Honda, you may recall, in the early part of the year to discuss this with you and also with the FASB chair. And we summarized very candidly, I think Russell, if you would agree, we said very candidly what had taken place during our roundtable with input from the chairs of the various sessions. That was presented as an annex to the press release. We announced our intention to form a private sector body, and in May of 2012, we actually issued the press release about the formation of the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. We were very, very pleased that we were able to have three very distinguished co-chairs of the EDTF, the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. Hugo Banziger, who many of you know is the chief, former chief risk officer and member of the management board of Deutsche Bank, now is the chairman of the supervisory board of Eurex Group. Russell Pico, my distinguished colleague to the right, who all of you know is chief accounting officer and group general manager at HSBC Holdings. And then Christian Strock, who's a managing director, a member of the investment committee and global credit research group of PIMCO. We wanted to make sure that from the very beginning of this effort that investors would understand that we intended for their voice to be very strongly heard as part of this very important initiative. The group was also asked to have a very strong and continuing outreach program so that as it was going through key stages in its effort, it would actually have outreach with standard setters, regulators, prudential authorities. So, for example, it was my privilege to work with the co-chairs to help to facilitate that outreach. We had outreach from the very beginning with IOSCO, Basel Committee, ISB, EN, and SUU participated in the first set of outreach, the FASB, IAASB, IFER, U.S. PCAOB, European Commission, ECB, and the rest, and EBA, ESMA, SEC, and the list goes on and on and on, not just in one area, but all around the world, actually. And turning to the next slide, which is really my last, let me just say that this was a very important joint private sector initiative comprised of senior officials and other experts from financial institutions at the chief risk officer level, chief financial officer level, and chief accounting official level, investors, analysts, credit rating agencies, and the big four audit firms at very senior expert levels. We asked them to do two or two and a half key things. I call it two and a half, probably three is a better way to characterize it. First, to develop principles for enhanced disclosures based on current market conditions and risks, including ways to enhance the comparability of disclosures. That's the point five of my in my analogy. But then also to identify leading practice risk disclosures based on annual reports that were issued for end year 2011. But looking at the broad risk areas that were identified in our summary of the roundtable that we issued, and the target was to report to the FSB by the end of October. And I have to say we were very pleased that the EDTF did that on the 29th of October. As you've seen, the report came out, published on the FSB's website, welcomed by the FSB, and then in its communique on the 5th of November, the G20 finance ministers, central bank governors also welcomed the report with very strong language. This whole effort seeks to enhance risk disclosure practices, beginning with certain aspects in 2012 annual reports for annual risk disclosures with fuller implementation 2013 and beyond, and it's uniquely designed for growing voluntary implementation. I'm going to leave that italicized last phrase in your mind for us to talk about perhaps as we go through Russell's presentation, but I just wanted to say that we're very pleased with what's happened. To have this quality of a report developed and issued in just a little over 5 months is really something which is very much appreciated by those who've had a chance to have dialogue with the co-chairs and to review this. Russell, I'll turn it over to you then to carry on and look forward to the dialogue that'll happen as Russell comes to his presentation.
Thanks, Jerry, and thank you very much, fans, for giving us the opportunity of coming to talk to you today, and indeed for your great willingness to participate in the outreach program sometimes at quite short notice, but it was very, very helpful. I'll start on page three of my...
You guys were so much quicker than we with all our due process. It's really fantastic.
it felt at times that we'd actually finished before we'd started. It was that fast. So I'll start off on page on slide three, just perhaps to do a little bit of scene setting. We had three co-chairs, 27 members. Broadly, a third of that membership was made up of institutional investor representatives, but it was very much a list of the very substantial houses who committed an amazing amount of energy and support into the project. We had a dozen banks from around the world. The major four accounting firms all were asked to nominate representatives. And we sought to get wide geographical representation. We held four face-to-face meetings in London, New York, Singapore, and Frankfurt. Now, at each of those meetings, so in London, my chairman, Douglas Flint, gave opening comments, and CEOs of the hosting organizations actually gave the opening introductory remarks at each of those meetings, which was very important in order to signify and signal CEO support. We ran with a very small secretariat, but I have to say that Jerry and Hiro Inoue from the Financial Stability Board provided enormous support to us. They attended every meeting, they occasionally gently twisted our arms when we needed a little bit of arm twisting, but they were absolutely fantastic. We ran with a small secretariat of three people, Del Anderson from PIMCO, Sandra Tartis from HSBC, and we're very fortunate to secure Liz Figge's services from, many of you will know Liz from ISB work. But that was very helpful because it formed a structure of how we were going to run the project. We allocated the 30 members of the task force to six work streams. That wasn't a democracy. We decided which work streams they were going to participate in. Only one person moved streams, so that was quite good. And we nominated six people to lead the work streams. Randomly, that was the big four accounting firms and the two trade associations. And they were very effective leaders because each of the member organizations had some infrastructure. We decided that an individual bank or an individual investment firm probably wouldn't have the international infrastructure to run a work stream. So that worked very well.
Can you say who are the trade associations? Which associations?
Yes. So there were seats given to the International Banking Federation who nominated the chairman of their accounting groups, a gentleman called Dirk Jaeger from the German Banking Association, and we secured the services of William Widdowson, who's a senior finance guy at UBS. Many of you know Will from his work with you over many years, who also chaired the IIF senior accounting group. So through those organizations, we were able to tap into their informal networks. And actually, both organizations were really helpful in providing some informal feedback on a very tight timescale to us when we actually shared some draft conclusions. It was interesting that around the four face-to-face meetings, we also carried out local outreach. So in each of those locations, we had a whole series of meetings with the regulatory community, both banking regulators and securities regulators, and also with the banks in that area. And that proved to be a very productive exchange. We asked them to tell us their views. We talked to them about where we were going, and that proves to be a very useful step in terms of building perhaps some consensus support. I mean, in terms of the meeting and in terms of the product, we've been asked this on a number of occasions. I mean, the reality is that this report was the result of some extremely intense discussions, and it absolutely was driven by the demands of the senior investor community that was represented on the task force. And that was moderated through the discussions with the banks and the audit firms. But it was quite significant, and I mean, Jerry, I'm sure, would recognize this, that the three co-chairs, we had never met before we actually participated in this task force, and we each had a shared vision of what we were trying to achieve. And we were all concerned that we would produce a report that would gather dust on the shelf and not be implemented and really not actually transform the industry as we'd wish to. But I think that because we had this shared vision, we were prepared to take some really quite difficult issues into the face-to-face meetings and hammer out an acceptable solution. And in the final meeting, the final face-to-face meeting, we actually went around the room and asked each of the individual investors present whether they were comfortable with signing up to the report, to be absolutely sure that we weren't dealing with something where the industry had somehow managed to water down to an unacceptable extent the industry's wishes, the investor industry wishes. So that was confirmed, and each of the organizations signed up to the report. So then just turning over, I mean, just noting the range of banks on the task force, I mean, these are a dozen or so names that would be very familiar to you all. There was a majority of representation from the risk function as opposed to the finance function, which is unusual for accounting-related disclosure projects, but I think that was very helpful. And we also got very wide geographical diversity. So we managed to tap into pretty much all the major geographical regions. So on page five, just a little bit of analysis of what the report looks like. So you'll have seen there are seven fundamental principles, 32 recommendations, supported by a number of pages of additional explanatory commentary, and there are some suggestions as to where banks may wish to go further. And then there is a compendium of leading best practice disclosures, which tries to give some examples of some existing disclosures which are good. But we particularly shine a light in the front half of the document, almost like an executive summary sense, on seven or eight example disclosures that the investors particularly would like to see the banks follow. And I'll talk to most of those in my presentation. One of the things I would say is that if you look at financial reporting at the moment, it is extremely affected at delivering a high-quality compliance product. So we've been asked on a number of occasions, is this report trying to rewrite the accounting rules? And the answer is no, it isn't. It's more that you can comply with accounting standards and listing authority obligations in a host of different ways, dozens of different ways of disclosure. And what this tries to do is to shine a light on perhaps a couple of particularly informative, clear ways of making those disclosures. And I'll come on to some of those thoughts. There are some recommendations which really sit outside the accounting bodies in the regulatory space, of particularly the Pillar 3 document. And there are a small number of areas where we are encouraging disclosure which is much more related to financial accounting and risk. And one of the key messages that we're trying to get across is this concept of transparency. Because if you look back at the crisis starting in 2007-2008, we would hope that the combination of the seven fundamental principles and the recommendations and really a mindset change in the industry would actually trigger a different behavior from the industry. What this group has enabled us to do is to actually bring together some banks and some investors into a room and actually have a very responsible discussion around what the investor needs are and how the banks can respond to that. And we do hope that we'll be able to keep a dialogue moving forward on this. So there is an expectation that in 2013, there will be some sort of gathering to actually talk about emerging risks in 2013 and how the industry should respond. And I think one of the litmus tests we tried to apply was looking at the report in the context of the crisis of 2007-2008. And would it have made a difference? And one of the areas which we think will be of enduring benefit are the seven principles. We do think it would have made a more effective industry response if the industry had been implementing a report of this nature back in those days. Slide six, this was written by Christian Strack from PIMCO. I asked him to actually summarize what he would have said were the main areas of investor concern. So we've talked about understanding the business model. And fundamentally what we're trying to convey here is a model which people can understand, and I'll explore that in a little bit greater depth. But the idea that you can actually describe what a bank does, which can be quite complex, and provide a high-level summary of what the key risks are which attach to each of those business activities, go to the risk section and be able to trace in a very straightforward and transparent manner the business model into the risks and then go to the balance sheet and P&L account and find the third-party assets and liabilities which attach to those risks and the business model. And to do the converse, start with the balance sheet and reverse trace through the risk section and the description of business model. I think the reality is at the moment that is pretty difficult to do. And as part of the meetings we did in October, the co-chairs went to Tokyo and we presented to the FSB plenary. We also were invited to present to a board meeting of the IIF. So we went into this room in Tokyo with 30 of the senior CEOs from the major banks in the world, my chairman there. And we described what we'd done and we described an example And I'd actually taken one of the banks in the room, I won't tell you which one, and we looked at their accounts, and I said that I'd tried to look at one of their descriptions, one of their activities, and to understand it. And I said I'd ended up with this 500-page document with all these coloured stickers scattered through the document, and I said I was unable to understand what actually the activity was which was described by the words they used, and I was pretty unclear how much risk was being taken, and I couldn't really understand what the assets were that business model was controlling.
Do you think the CEO in question understood?
And the reaction in the room indicated that they understood this quite well. They actually recognized the issue, that their accounts ticked all the boxes, but there was something missing, which was this transparency of message. So it was really difficult to do.
Do you think that the majority of the CEOs had a full grasp of what their business model really is?
I think they do. I think, depending on the quality of their own MI, they'll have a lesser or greater appreciation of how those linkages really, really work, to be honest. And we gave a very simple example. We didn't choose anything particularly difficult to test them
on. Which does that then mean? I remember from my time as minister that I always, in my annual statement of this budget, I always wrote the summary or the main statements. I wrote them myself to force myself also to get a full grasp of what my ministry was doing. The fact that you cannot find that in these financial statements, I really wonder. If you are fully aware of the complete business model of your bank, wouldn't you go to pains to explain that to people? Why is it not there at the moment?
Yeah, I think the reality actually, Hans, is because of this compliance culture which has grown up around financial reporting. That I guess there is a system that doesn't really reward at the moment going beyond being able to say you've complied with accounting standards and you've made all the disclosures. And you can make all the disclosures, you can scatter them in 30 different places.
There another moment or place where they give this general message to investors?
I think there are varying degrees of success in that, to be fair. I think when we looked around the banks, there are clearly some good examples of disclosure where there are, and we've reproduced those in the report. There are charts and diagrams which provide very clear signposting. I have to say, I think it's patchy, and I think there would be almost no bank amongst the major banks that wouldn't say, when they look at this report, we could do a better job. I know my own bank is working hard on actually looking at revamping our 2012 annual report and accounts to try and improve this. So I think the industry recognises there is a lot that can be done. Hopefully the industry recognises it.
Can I ask a question on the third bullet point, lack of timely reporting?
Yes.
Surprise, because each of the banks which are on the list, and many others, do quarterly reports, which I think are very detailed quarterly reports. Does that mean that those reports are not effective in updating the risk profile?
Okay, so I think there's three issues there. there's firstly, there is the financial reporting regime and the regulatory reporting regime. So, as you know, the European banks comply with Pillar 3. Generally, those Pillar 3 documents do not come out at the same time. They're not released at the same time as the annual report and accounts, and that may follow some weeks after a preliminary results announcement. My own bank, as you know, publishes its annual report and accounts on the same day as its Pillar 3 document. So we release all of the information, both the financial risk information and the regulatory analysis. One of the interesting takeaways that I took from this industry group was that the investors mine the Pillar 3 documents because, as we'll see, the whole area of adequacy of capital, transparency of risk-weighted assets, the use of models is a major, major industry concern. So, in fact, the FSB recommended in 2011 the Pillar 3 documents should be published early. And, in fact, we were merely repeating that recommendation. But the response has been quite interesting. We received a couple of letters from banks who disagreed with this recommendation and suggested that their response would be to delay publishing their annual reports as opposed to accelerating their Pillar 3 documents, which does suggest that there is still some mindset changing to be achieved here.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with the quarterly versus annual, then, it's just the timing.
And then on the quarters, so generally half year and full year provide quite dense information. There is no uniform standard across the world for balance sheet and P&Ls, even in Europe. You know, Europe has an interim management statement. We drew back from moving into recommendations which were outside our scope. But there's a separate issue as to whether companies in Europe, for example, should produce balance sheets and P&Ls for Q1 and Q3. There is a recognition in this report that you simply can't make risk disclosures once or twice a year, because when you have an emerging issue, it does really... I think it behoves the bank and the management to go on the front foot and to speak to that issue in a quantitative manner. And I think there are encouraging signs. For example, the Eurozone disclosures that you'll have seen amongst the European banks, those look like they're being summarised and updated on a quarterly basis in terms of best practice. This will need to get tested, though, in terms of industry response to the next crisis, which they will surely be.
Russell.
Yep.
You did mention the, you know, current report required by the regulators.
Yes.
Yeah, in particular, in the capital market, regulators require you to disclose price-sensitive information. Now, this kind of disclosure is useful, or?
So we had an interesting discussion about disclosure of commercially sensitive information. And within the principles, you'll have seen there are some words around this. We don't believe this report is asking banks to disclose information which is commercially sensitive. We don't think that's where we're going. And if you look at, for example, stress testing, which is probably an area of quite significant commercial sensitivity, and rightfully so, we haven't recommended or mandated quantitative disclosure of the outcomes of stress testing. We didn't think that would be appropriate. But apart from that, I think it's quite difficult outside naming individual customers to think of many really good examples where there could be commercial sensitivity. Clearly, in the area of litigation and potentially regulatory investigations, you're going to be constrained by the legal issues that you'll be facing. But we do believe that you can go a long way to complying with the report without actually tripping commercial sensitivity. So we would expect... As we're doing our outreach to institutional investors, which we've done a couple of meetings in London where we've probably spoken to 30-plus investors, we have said we do not expect to see commercial sensitivity being used as a shield for lack of disclosure by the banks that are following us. A couple of areas just very briefly. Obviously, another major area at the moment is liquidity and funding. Number of very important disclosures on that. And then finally, a quite technical area all around credit risk and reported impaired loans and forbearance and restructuring. And I've got some prepared remarks on that later. So moving on to slide 7 on the fundamental principles. We've just reproduced these here. I think it's quite difficult to disagree with them. And actually, I would say that these aren't bank-specific, actually. I think these would be applicable to pretty much any company in any industry, and they could be regarded as motherhood and apple pie. But we do think they have real teeth if you comply with these, and when you read them, language such as clear, balanced, and understandable is a challenge in an industry as technical as banking. But let's give an example. The words investment portfolio, that's an expression used by many banks. There is no standard definition. I think those words can be used to describe an activity that can encompass anything from a very plain vanilla, low-risk activity to a very high-risk activity. That's the sort of issue we're trying to drive at. Labeling, which doesn't misdescribe what's going on and that actually can be readily accessible to the industry. The investors extract a penalty. They charge a premium when they don't understand things because of the uncertainty. So we believe these represent a very powerful package. There is some intention between principles 4 and 6. We're a great believer that through the eyes of management philosophy, management should describe how it's actually managing risk. There is real interest in the market in understanding that. But then how do you balance that with achieving comparability across the industry? We talked about that on a number of occasions in the task force. We don't think we can resolve that. We think it's probably not a resolvable conflict. But we do see a role over the coming year or so, perhaps for the industry associations to do some work amongst their banking members to think about ways in which we could try and drive greater comparability.
So would you see 4 as a higher priority than 6?
I mean, because it's a higher number or lower number? I think
it is important, isn't it, to know how the individual organisation...
Yeah, and we as you can imagine, Ian, we did have a lot of discussions around mandating disclosures, templates and the like, and there wasn't support for that, I have to say. My own view, and I think it is the view of the investing community, is the power of making management describe what it actually does gives a sense of the quality of the risk management process. And that's partly what the investors are trying to judge, as well as understanding the numbers that go with that. There is, I think, a great responsibility that goes with bank management because you are going to, as it were, set out your stall and you'll be judged on that. So I believe 4 is absolutely the right principle, and it's a principle that the board here has espoused. I think it is the right philosophy. I think all we're saying is that if you can achieve some comparability within that, that's really helpful. But we haven't tried to mandate templates and the like.
And also very, very nicely, as you'll see later in Russell's presentation, he has some very good material from the report, which actually does help to strengthen comparability while at the same time recognizing the important need for disclosures to reflect how risk is being managed.
On point 6, comparability, and you mentioned that further work could be undertaken. Yeah. It seems to me that, as an external observer, that the banking industry is using a lot of technical terms, jargon, which are unique to the industry, yeah. And that the investors maybe believe that it is the same understanding of those terms by the industry. Might not be true. It might be that each bank has its own definition of what is the meaning of that or this. So do you think there is some room for doing some work to try to reach common definitions of those terms? Yes.
Yes, and in principle 1, Philippe, it says terms used in the disclosures should be explained or defined. In fact, the UK bank service, you know, have a disclosure code, and we each publish a glossary, and we have done quite a lot of work over the last couple of years trying to harmonise definition of individual banks. I think generally the industry, there is an opportunity to do more. Where there is no particular reason to have 15 different definitions, if you can agree on one, it's much better.
Russell, wait, go, because we have only 20 minutes left and a lot of sheets. Yep. So I would recommend you go on with your presentation and collect our questions.
That's fine.
Sure. Until the end, okay.
Thank you. So I'll skip slide 8. Slide 8, the only takeaway is that 1/3 of the recommendations are on capital and risk-weighted assets out of the 30 or so. So moving on to slide 9, which I pick out some of the main recommendations. And I'll move on to slide 11, and I'll be shuffling backwards and forwards these examples. So slide 11 is an example of a table or a chart which would summarise what a bank's business model. So you would expect to see something like this right up front in annual report and accounts. And as you can see, this is an example of a business which has got 5 main businesses and a central treasury. And what we're trying to do is to then articulate the risk on a proportional basis. So you can see, for example, the central treasury takes some market risk. As you'd expect to see, the investment bank has a large proportion of the bank's market risk. But you can also see in the retail bank, there is some market risk. So that could be because not all the risk has been transferred into the central treasury. There could be some prepayment optionality in residential mortgages, for example. So this is a very high-level signpost that actually gives a reader an overall landscape of the big picture of where risk is. Then moving forward, and I'll talk through the examples. So slide 12 and 13. My own view is that this might be the single most important recommendation we've made. What this is a flow statement of risk-weighted assets split by the major type of risk-weighted assets. So this is not a financial statement disclosure. It's a regulatory-driven disclosure. All it tries to do is to take the beginning RWA number and reconcile how it's moved to the closing position. But really what it brings out is the extent to which risk-weighted assets have benefited from model changes made by that bank. And that is clearly one of the areas that the investors are concerned about, is the extent to which models are being used to as it were, provide risk-weighted asset relief. That is accompanied by some recommendations to provide core factual information. So there is there's a wide diversity of practice amongst the regulatory community. For example, in some countries, you need to get the regulator to pre-approve changing model. In some countries, management provides attestation, and the internal process is sufficient for the change. The number of years historical data that is used to underpin our model for credit risk. All that core information isn't getting out into the market now, and we're asking for that to be presented. And these disclosures could make a real difference to the market's understanding of risk-weighted assets and will provide a really rich seam of information for the investors to talk to bank management about why they're seeing these numbers. And a particular example that would be on page 14. It is unashamedly a very granular table. We have a lot of discussion around this and whether or not we should be recommending a standardized RWA calculation, which we didn't. This table provides a management view of the wholesale risk of how that this bank's exposures are allocated across internal ratings with a PD band. You can calculate from that in the far right-hand side what we would call RWA density, so the average risk weighting attaching to each of those risk buckets, and then you would be able to map that to an external credit rating approach as well. If we could get that published for the major portfolios, that would enable then the market to cross-compare across the industry and to have those interesting discussions with management about, well, why are your RWAs for this product very low, the bank next door is very different, et cetera, et cetera. So we think this is very, very useful disclosure. One of the other areas, and let me say right at the outset, IFRS mandates disclosure of pledged assets. I think the problem is that those disclosures are generally fragmented and quite difficult to bring together. What this table asks for is an asset encumbrance table. There was a lot of discussion about whether we should use the word table. There were some banks that would have liked just to have a narrative. We said that we would strongly encourage a tabular presentation because it clearly drives to the proportion of a bank's balance sheet which is free and available to meet the possible claims of third-party creditors. What this is trying to do is to almost deconsolidate what is a complex process. So if I take HSBC, you know, we have insurance businesses. Clearly the assets of those regulated insurance businesses aren't freely available to be transferred to my banking subsidiaries to meet the claims of depositors. So we also consolidate structured investment vehicles and conduits. Those assets are also not freely available. So we see this table as being very important to provide real insight into the structure of a balance sheet. Clearly there are banks that are very heavily dependent on central bank funding, and generally they have pledged relatively high levels of assets in support of that. This table will provide a very deep insight into that, but it should be taken as the starting point for a really high quality analysis of what's actually happening. So this is, again, one of those very important disclosures. The next table is an interesting example of market risk. So the discussions around market risk, generally there are some quite good disclosures. But I think the important point that the investors were trying to strive for was two things. First of all, they'd like to understand in what way market risk, the primary risk management measures are deficient. So VAR is a typical measure. It's supplemented by a number of other measures nowadays because it doesn't deal with tail risk very well and is very heavily dependent on the inputs. Equally, market risk arises outside the trading room, and the market would like to understand in a very clear way the size of that and how it's managed. So a table like this provides some sort of signposting to where market risk may be taken and where it may be managed in a different way from the main trading risk. Then slide 17, again a very straightforward recommendation, please reconcile your opening to closing non-performing loans. Generally that's not done. It would be very helpful to the market for banks to do this. So again, we would like to see that starting in 2012. Clearly, it provides information about the pace of origination of NPLs and to the extent they're cured and written off, etc. So very straightforward table. Generally, it would be appreciated to produce that. And let me move on to some areas that might be particularly of interest to the board on slides 18 and 19. We were, of course, very mindful of existing IFRS and US GAAP. I think that I can think of no example where the conclusions of our report is inconsistent with IFRS 7. IFRS 7 has two bold print paragraphs, which are the substance of IFRS 7. We believe that spirit absolutely is reflected in the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. We've been unprescriptive about where the disclosures should be made. We can put them in the accounts, audited, or the MD&A, or indeed in Pillar 3. And clearly these recommendations build on the foundation of GAAP. Slide 19 is where I perhaps get a bit more intrusive in terms of the board and focus on some areas of particular interest. Firstly, and this is quite granular, in US GAAP land, US GAAP underpins credit quality with a definition of non-performing loans and has a concept of troubled debt restructuring, which has recently been strengthened, which means that generally US GAAP banks have got highly comparable disclosures. That's not true in IFRS universe, and I think the view of the banks and indeed the investor community is that there is really quite a pressing need for some work to be done, ideally by the board, to come up with some common definitions of what constitutes an impaired loan, how you define that, under what circumstances you can cure a loan which may have been modified, and indeed what your loan forbearance policies are. I think it'd be fair to say when IFRS 7 was produced, and as you probably all know, I chaired an advisory group that looked at that, the focus was very much on individual loan impairment. I think the reality over the last few years is that a lot of portfolios are provisioned on a collective basis. So you don't have this nice, when you have an individual loan, it's very clear if it's impaired or not. That's not the problem. The problem is when you have a portfolio, you tend to be looking at delinquency buckets. So what do you call a non-performing loan? Do you say it's 90 days past due? And what do you do about modifications? Under what circumstances can you modify a loan, perhaps charge off an initial allowance against that, and then regard that loan as then complying with the new terms and curing, and therefore no longer being classified as a non-performing loan? This is a real issue right now in the banking industry, and I think it's one of the areas that we would very positively encourage. If there's any possibility of you looking at that, I think it would be really well received by the investor community. One of the perhaps surprising recommendations we got from the investors was around maturity analysis of assets and liabilities. I think we probably expected a request for a behavioral analysis. In fact, that wasn't what they asked for. They actually asked for a contractual maturity analysis, because they regarded that as providing them with the essential raw materials on which they will then carry out their own behavioral assessment. That probably says something about the degree of trust which we've managed to engender in the investing community. So that's the recommendation. There's also an encouragement to describe the behaviorization policy. Obviously, we've got a whole package of disclosure recommendations around liquidity and funding. There was a discussion around the usefulness of the cash flow statement. This won't be news to you. General sense, it wasn't really helpful to the investor community. So I think they would be, I think, encouraging you to, if you could look at that, that would be helpful. I guess then just closing, looking at what's then happened. Obviously, as Jerry said, we had very strong support from Mark Carney and the Financial Stability Board, welcoming the publication of the report and recognising it as being a major step, and also encouraging the banks to actually strive to improve their risk disclosures, and perhaps uniquely recognition by the G20. Very unusual for the G20 to acknowledge a private sector report. We tried to orchestrate some private sector support, so my own bank and Douglas Flint provided a quote, came out on the day the report was published with a very strong support from HSBC. We regard our position in this as being very clear. We wish to be a market leader. We will strive very hard to implement the full conclusions and recommendation of this report, and we're working very hard to try and get as much done as we can in 2012.
You kept your job.
Well, that was what I was asked by one of the regulators. In fact, he said, you can't leave until you've done this, actually, Hans. I feel like I was being chained to my desk. And there's been a very strong expression support from a number of banks and indeed investors, as well as obviously delighted with the support we had from you, Hans, and FASB, as well as the big four accounting firms. And we do know a number of banks are working hard at trying to comply with this. We are trying to build some momentum. As Jerry said, this is a purely voluntary report. We have no mandate to tell anyone to do anything. A number of industry meetings have been held. There's been a meeting of the IB Fed. There's an upcoming meeting of the IF next month. In the UK, there's already been a number of meetings amongst the UK banks, and we know there's been other meetings across the world. We've had some investor outreach already, a meeting coming up with New York. That has triggered real interest. I was in a room yesterday evening with 20 investors for close on an hour and a half. Very, very interested in this. We asked them to go away and demand these disclosures to be made by the banks, because we think one of the big signals is to get strong investor pull for the information to encourage banks to do this. And we know that the likes of PIMCO and M&G, BlackRock, amongst others, are also trying to encourage the banks to do this. So we still think there is much work to be done in securing the industry response, which would signal the change of mindset that we would like to see. So let me stop there, Hans. Very happy to take any more questions or discuss any aspects of this, if any, on sort of thing that might
As ESMA, I'm surprised ESMA has not reacted in support of I don't see this. And because recently they issued a statement on the areas of interest for the current year closing, and many of the points are related to what you're trying to improve here, and it didn't seem to express any.
We were very pleased, Philippe, to have very good dialogue with Steve Mayor. In fact, Steve Mayor was actually at the roundtable on risk disclosure in December. There also was outreach that the co-chairs had with him as the report was being finalized. And so I can only say that he's indicated his strong interest in the effort, and I'm sure that there'll be a supportive view of this going forward.
Otherwise, we can help build momentum is the securities regulators in trying to promote and kind of make it a benchmark against which they would appreciate the quality of information.
But they would be a member of OSCO, Jerry? Yes, but would be a member of OSCO?
They're very heavily involved with all the security regulatory processes.
But that was a member of the FSB.
Excuse me.
The OSCO was represented at the FSB.
Yeah,
so
OSCO's.
They may consider that they're part of the broader FSB endorsement. Mm-hmm. Expressions for
there you go.
Simple question. Well, on page 7, the balanced, what does that mean? Is the cost benefit of aggregation or disaggregation? You know, I'm not sure. And second question is, you mentioned that there's no general definition for the non-performing loans compared to US.
Yeah.
How about the regulatory world?
I think that differs from Basel's. That differs from country to country. So you'd have regulatory reporting driven off a particular definition, but that would be for regulatory reports. That might not mean that you then would have consistency across a national jurisdiction amongst the banks. And if you then go regional, I'm sure you would see there could be quite a disparity of reporting practice amongst the European banks. Sorry, I didn't catch your first question. Page 7 of the slides.
Balanced. First principle. What does balance mean?
I think it means that you need to provide a balance between words and numbers, and between using narrative disclosures, figures, and graphical presentations. What this is trying to do is to provide an improved messaging and communication. Don't just believe that you can write 2 pages of long prose, which some banks do at the moment, with a message buried in a whole series of sentences with numbers and percentages, etc. And if you look at the leading best practice examples, a lot of those are very clear charts and tables, which provide a much clearer messaging. So that's the idea of balanced, I think.
Errol, did you?
And I think this is a great idea, and I think it also helps fill the gap between what we do, which is not necessarily purely industry focused,
yep,
and gives a very specific industry focus to it. We tried something along these lines. We worked along these lines from a single entity perspective previously. One of the challenges we had was that a proper single risk report that brings together all of the elements effectively combines your IFRS 7 reporting, mm-hmm, It combines regulatory reporting
yep.
with a very strong overtone of MD&A type of thing.
Yep.
And we found that incredibly difficult to get through an audit process because mm-hmm. you had components that needed to be audited and components that didn't. Mm-hmm. Did that come up at all as part of this issue?
It did, actually. So I think when we talk about one place, I think what we mean is that within a particular report, you should be able to see all the market risk disclosures in one place. I think in our minds, we did have this idea that you should be able to put the Pillar 3 document next to the annual report, and you would see disclosure in both places, but that you would be able to see the same structure analysis between the two documents. If you take credit risk, for example, Darryl, you don't want to see a sectoral analysis in the IFRS risk disclosures and a completely different basis for analysis of credit risk RWAs, such that you can't look at the two through the same lens. So that's the sort of change we'd like to try and build, that sort of practice. But I think your point is well made. I mean, a lot of Pillar 3 disclosures don't really sit very well in general purpose financial statements, and I think we recognise that. Yeah.
Just three short comments. The first one is I'm a little surprised of you find difficulty defining the impairment in the banks. So that's the some surprise to us. You know. Another thing
you don't find it easy either, Changwu.
Right. The second one is you are suggesting all nice tables here look very excellent, but the lack of experience in the financial institutions, whether what these tables are good for specific uses, with some examples, mm-hmm. why the example these tables are useful mm-hmm. In predicting some or evaluating some prudence or some anyway, I don't mm-hmm. know. The final thing is the seven principles. Mm-hmm. Quite similar to our conceptual framework. But there is one important thing is missing. The difference is representation of faithfulness was not in the seven principles. Why? Is there any good reason?
So in terms of the tables are provided and the movement analysis is because there is believed to be really important information. So on the NPLs, for example, the rate of creation of new non-performing assets is clearly a very useful piece of information given to the market. It's generally not very easy to find right now, I would say. Definition of impaired loans, as I said in my remarks, it's very easy when you have an individual account. It's actually very difficult when you're in portfolios, particularly consumer and SME lending, where you have a delinquency approach to provisioning with roll rates, and you have a practice of modification. And it immediately gets very, very subjective and quite difficult. And it's driven by policy, bank by bank. And the reality is there isn't good disclosure right now. So I think it's very difficult to actually find the bank's policy to then unravel really what the anchor number is for collectively impaired assets. And we do think, it's a pretty technical area and you probably need to do a bit of, and we'd be happy to privately come and talk to you about some of that. To perhaps shine a little bit more light on that. Faithfulness was talked about. I think we felt we didn't need to necessarily completely align with any particular framework. We actually felt that the seven principles, which were drafted by the investors as opposed to the bank preparers, provided the right framework. I think faithfulness could be read into a concept of clear balance and understandable, for example, comprehensive. I think the fact we haven't used the word, I don't think means that we don't agree with the concept. We just perhaps have expressed it in a slightly different way. We think it's highly consistent there, John.
Paul, just a small question. Do you think these disclosures, what's the impact of these on segment reporting, on reporting operating segment information? Does that make our segment information really less relevant?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there was a discussion about whether or not we should actually be dipping a toe into the segmental reporting world, and we drew back because we said that's financial reporting, that's not our job. I think it absolutely expresses the importance of segmental reporting, actually. Paul, we regard that as being a really important feature of current bank reporting. It's essential. you know, you'll see in the major banks, they typically will provide both geography and global business line. That's what HSBC does. We're not unique in that respect. Absolutely the right thing to drive through financial reporting.
Yeah. Martin?
One question. Do you think that Mansis, a lot of banks will adopt this kind of recommendations, or do you expect really from regulators, from standard setters, from others that they have to change their rules based on your recommendations, based on your principles, or do you rely really on that financial institutions will do it voluntarily over time and you don't expect it from organizations to move in this direction?
That's a hard question, Martin. So what we hope is that the member banks on the task force, we think they're signed up to implement this. It's a question of how quickly they do that. We think that because of the wide geographical distribution, we've effectively got an anchor bank in all of the major markets. And the reality was that anchor bank went and talked to its major peers. That's very clear in my own country and others. And what we're hoping is that dialogue, perhaps with a little bit of positive encouragement, perhaps from their banking regulator, will then see the voluntary implementation. I think it'll be really disappointing if we don't see that, frankly, because the benefits of actually, I mean, we think there is a real competitive advantage to be gained from complying with this report on a voluntary basis for making your disclosures much more understandable. I mean, as you know, most banks are trading below book value right now. They've got quite difficulty funding in many markets. And there's some reasons for that, and we think transparency is really helpful at trying
Hopefully it will be a competitive disadvantage if you do not...
Well, we didn't expect the ISB, for example, or FASB to say, you know, we're going to hard code this as standards, or indeed the SEC or any particular individual regulator. Yeah.
Amaru?
Yeah, very somewhat follow-up question on that.
Yeah.
I think I totally agree with your assessment of the perspective on this. But you mentioned when you were talking about the group in slide 5 that you foresee a potential regathering in 2013 or 2014.
Yes.
But at that point, you mentioned to assess new issues.
Yes.
So my question following up this could be that is this regarding or the Financial Stability Board assess the effective implementation of this recommendation.
Jeremy, do you want to?
I'll mention a few things in that respect. One, let me say that just to answer the earlier question, that the Basel Committee has indicated it's, and there's been very good dialogue with the co-chairs about the report. They're considering it as an input to their process to update Pillar 3 disclosures. To your point, Amaro, the FSB has a very good track record of having follow-up reviews to assess implementation. As you know, we have groups within the FSB that are dedicated to that. And this whole process actually came out of a thematic review to assess what had happened with our earlier recommendations. We are very much supportive of having a further roundtable next year to be able to talk not only about how risks and bank risk profiles, current market conditions have changed, but also to talk about and review and have a very, very candid discussion around implementation. There's also a lot of things that are going on in encouraging various organizations and associations to undertake voluntarily initiatives that will help to advance implementation progress over 2013, 2012 first, and then 2013 and beyond. So I think you're going to see some very important steps being undertaken in 2013, 2014 to move this forward.
And I think the hope is that we've actually, I mean, this, I know this is an issue the board has really strived very hard to deal with. The reality is historically it's been really difficult to get institutional investors to commit the time and energy to improving the financial reporting process.
Tell us about it.
And disclosure. This was incredible. I mean, these guys worked tirelessly. They formed a little industry group of their own. They worked. They had a lot of contact outside of the meetings. I think it's very clear. We have the nucleus of a forum that we could bring together to talk about an emerging issue the next time it comes. And that, I think, gives us hope that we can actually respond much better in the future.
We also made it very clear from the FSB's perspective that for this initiative to be successful, it had to improve the information set and the timeliness of information that investors use to assess bank risk profiles and bank risk management practices. We're very pleased, and Pat, you probably followed this. The CFA Institute issued a very positive release. Krupp also, as Russell's mentioned in his slides, issued a very positive release. BlackRock, PIMCO, PGGM, the list goes on. We're very pleased. But they are also energized to be active in helping to widen the circle of investors, analysts, and others, even within the credit rating agency community. Fitch and others have been very positive. So I think that there's a momentum that is continuing to help those that are users to be able to have a very important voice in asking for implementation, which in itself can help to reinforce and encourage better voluntary implementation practices by financial institutions.
Russell, Jerry, thank you so much for taking the trouble and time to come and discuss this with us. I think it was a very good discussion and very enlightening presentation. So again, thank you, and hope to see you soon again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.